Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You have listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and we are very excited, very pumped up, very fired up. Have another day, the day of Jummah, for our non-Muslim friends. Want to continue to welcome you to our show. This show is not a Muslim show. It's a program. Muslim brother, I'm your servant. I serve God from serving you. I noticed on the Who Follows Up, we have a very prominent AME preacher in South Carolina. I won't say any more about him. Every time we post on Facebook, he posts us and share with us. So, Reverend, God bless you. We thank you for continuing to listen. You remain being a good Christian. I know you're going through your month, a week of sacrifice, and maybe not this Sunday, but next Sunday I'll teach on this meaning as I understand it. That God has blessed me to understand it. God has blessed you, too, to have a leader, a teacher, and a guide based on your grandmamas, your great-great-great-grandmamas' prayers. They prayed a song. They prayed a prayer, rather. Lord, will the circle be unbroken? By and by, by and by. And we are thankful to Almighty God that He has unbroken the circle. And there's no more secret knowledge today. God has blessed us through one of our own, Imam Waruddin Muhammad, who is a leader for us all. And he's not a leader just for Muslims. He's a leader for our people and thus the world. So with that in mind, we go to the station, the last station really of the cross, where we were crucified, slain, nailed to the cross. Blood came running out of us. That's, if you want to see a picture of the crucifixion, just look at what happened to us in America. But one of those last stations before we start rising, to use that analogy, was Selma, Alabama. And today, one who's able to interpret that dream, his name is Yusuf, Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. Shrewd, first of all, he's a man of God, a man that believes in God, a servant of God, serve people. But he's an educated man and a man that knows the law and knows about politics. He and I share an undying commitment to the resurrection of all people. And he's calling, he's here with us from the state of Alabama, a state that Dr. King was said was dripping with nullification. Well, I want to ask him, does he see any parallel between the governor, the sitting governor of the state of Alabama, the former governor of the state of Alabama that's now in federal prison, and a federal judge that sentenced the former governor who is still in jail, and the federal judge himself was forced to step down from the bench or be impeached and might have gone to jail. He's now had to go back into private practice. They didn't take his license from him. There's a lot going on. I didn't even realize that even the Speaker of the House in the state of Alabama, the state that produced George Wallace, Governor Patterson, whole series of reckless men and women, is now facing some great challenges. According to the Birmingham News, the paper that used to feature Mr. Bull Connors, state that was made famous by the great Reverend Shuttleworth. I'm going to shut up and ask our brother and friend to make a comment or to inform us what's going on in Alabama. I was so disturbed, I texted him and asked him what they drinking down there. I've never in my life seen three high officials that fall from grace. And the question is whether or not the governor will be able to survive. I don't know, as a practicing attorney, are you free to discuss these matters? But if so, if you would give us your spiritual insights.
Let me say this. First of all, let me greet everybody in peace. Let me say, I served in the State House with Governor Bentley. The last conversation I had with Governor Bentley was that he was discussing with me the fact that he might run for governor. At the time, with what I knew about Alabama politics, I thought it would be a Don Quixote run. But surprisingly, he won. And Governor Bentley always came across to me as a responsible man, a very Christian man. Also served with Speaker of the House, Mike Hubbard. And he didn't give a quarter to Democrats. He was very, very tough. And I'm sure since he got the gavel, he's tough now. But I've never really been shown anything but graciousness Speaker of the House, Mike Hubbard. Now, let me just move on beyond that. I think you see in these Caucasian males in Alabama something that's all across the country. People don't want to acknowledge because he got money, but Trump has similar problems. Look how many of the Republican Caucasian males. The Republicans started off with 17 candidates, and many of them Caucasian males that could not stand the campaign muster. I'm giving you the facts now, okay? Out of the remaining four that was left at one time, 50% were Hispanics, Rubio and Cruz, and two Caucasian males. As of now, there is a close contest in the sense of the Republican process, not delegates, between this Hispanic and this Caucasian male, Donald Trump. Now, beyond the personality quirks that Governor Bentley may have had, which I can't say, I'm just going by the news reports, Speaker of the House Mike Hubbard, I do know that Alabama was a state that refused to accept the Medicaid monies that could come through the state through Obamacare. Before this happened with Governor Bentley, the House of Representatives and the Senate put forth a bill where they were $50 million in the hole, buddy, ma'am, on this Medicaid thing. The governor was threatening to veto this budget before these allegations hit the public awareness. Now, I can go to the personal charges against Bentley and Speaker of the House of it, but as Muslims, we have to see this in the bigger context. What you have is during the same time, President Obama went to Cuba, took his family down there. A man that nobody has been able to bring any scandal. No scandal against his wife. His mother was a widow. No scandal against her. No scandal against these two daughters. But this man has been subject to constant abuse and character assassination since he been president. This is a day of Yom Kippur. This is a day of revelation. To me, these events must occur, Brother Imam, to reveal the true situation, and that the excellent Joseph, free of a lot of taint, is this African Hamish man, President Barack Hussein Obama. But in contrast, look at the behavior of these Caucasian males on both the national level and in my state of Alabama, if true. It's a striking contrast. To me, that's a more important lesson than the narrow situation as to what's going to happen to him and legally and what have you. That's a public notice, and it should be delved into. But as Muslims, we got a unique perspective. The bigger thing that's happening is clear now through the unfolding of events that, as a general rule, the Caucasian male in America has fallen from his high standards of leadership. And while this has happened, the Creator has raised up a Hamish African man that stands ascribed above them morally, spiritually, intellectually, and in any other way of gauging human excellence. To me, that's the bigger takeaway.
All right, let me just ask you about Pope Francis washing the feet of Muslim immigrants. What do you make of that story? You know, of course, the ritual, and I hope you'll explain it to us. I know you're not one of these babby boo Muslims who, you know, every Arabic word, you're worried about this, whether you pronounce the ayin and the gain and all the esoteric or not. That's not important, but certainly that's just a roadmap to how we build a society.
Some of you call it that important. I don't see it. The book came down upon the heart. It's the Kaaba Sharif that's really important. Not saying that that doesn't have value, but it's a difference between saying something has value, Brother Imam, and elevating it to the level of importance in our deen. Brothers Imams and scholars, they may disagree with me on that. But the same thing about Al-Islam is a Kaaba Sharif given to Taqwa.
Yes, let me
give it to Taqwa.
What do you make?
I just wanted to say that, and we can go back to your question that you were shaping. I'm sorry.
I wanted to, I was just kind of commenting on the way, because we're going to talk a little bit more about where we are at in turn via visa. The message of Imam Muhammad and why it hasn't gotten to the public. But I wanted to get to the big message that the Pope of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, as he's really called, technically called, washing the feet of Muslim immigrants there in Rome. Why is it, with all the learning folks being these Muslim seats of learning, Muslims have to migrate to Italy, and the Pope had to send a message? And if he did send a message, which he has, what do you read as that he's washing the feet? And as he put it, we're all children of God. We know we're not children of God. We're the creation.
Yes, sir, I understand the statement. I understand. Yes,
I
understand. Sir.
I'd like you to make a comment on that.
Well, Brother Imam, you know nature abhors a vacuum. The Muslim leadership around the world has not washed any feet, and the feet of the Muslim masses are becoming stinky every day. So the Pope, who also has written a book saying that the name of God is mercy, that's just like entitled in the book, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, okay? Same idea. We know that both of those terms have a mercy component to them. And he wrote this book where he's imitating Prophet Muhammad and what he brought by saying the name of God is mercy. Bismillah. me that the Pope is sending a signal that the Muslim world would be wise to clean up the foundations of society by bringing us back to sober, sound, moral sentiments, sensibilities that's rooted in the natural nature of Adam. And I respect him for sending that message. Even within the context of our imams, we love to try to shine a nugget, shine a head, shine a brain. Love to do that, to show off our signs.
Let me ask you this.
But are we humble enough to get down on our feet and wash each other's feet? That's a very important question. Did I answer your question, brother?
You certainly do, and you lead me to the next question. With a close to 500 Muslim imams, maybe a couple thousand, prominent imams and the associate imam, W.D. Muhammad, have you seen any indication of them washing the feet? Of not even that congregation? I want to know. I know they haven't washed the feet of our neighborhoods because our neighborhoods wouldn't be stinky the way they are. But I want to know whether they've washed the feet of our congregations.
Brother Imam, I think too much time and energy is being spent on the mountaintop of obsession with knowledge acquisition, almost an Iblisian type sentiment, which I would hesitate to attribute that, where I'm so good because of my knowledge. And I don't want to participate in the humble Adamic work of washing some feet. I'm better than that. Now, Prophet Muhammad said, and Imam said, Prophet Muhammad wanted to work in the valley, not on the mountain's top. And Imam Muhammad said that was his preference, to be down in the valley. Well, when you walk in the valley of the shadow of moral, spiritual, and intellectual death, you got to get down on your knees, Brother Imam, and wash some feet. If you're a genuine, not just Imam, but religious leader, period, you must be willing to get on your knees in the valley without the glamour, without the glory of the mountaintop transfiguration, posturing and projecting oneself as some wise Islamic scholar or preacher. Get down in the valley, Brother Imam, and wash feet. Pete, I don't think that's happening in our masjid. If it is, alhamdulillah, all praises due to God. But I don't think so. You can look at it. I was talking to a brother in Atlanta. I called up there about him helping me find a marital partner for my granddaughter. This brother is in his 50s, and he complaining about the Muslim brothers up there in the masjid. It's very difficult for them to find a wife. Well, if they're not masked off and they don't have partners, we know what's going to happen with that. The feet's going to get stinking when it comes to intimacy. And I said, well, what's happening, brother? He said, well, there's no drive, like the imam said, to get married. And when you go to a sister, she quoting $50,000 for dowry. Man, please, that sounds insane to me. But that's just my personal opinion.
No, sir. No, sir. I disagree with you. It is a learned opinion. I would say that if you were a jackleg imam who probably knew, had not heard Imam Muhammad, but you sat at Imam Muhammad's audience, you've been in his classroom, you've read and studied him. So that's an informed opinion, and according to Islamic law, that would count as ijma, one who has... all you shakes out there, y'all know I was a milkshake too. So anyway, yes, no, that's informed opinion. The first foundation of society is the family, marital life. Imam called he said those are the sacred life connection. So any leader, Christian, Muslim, or otherwise, who is not working to preserve the family is actually serving Satan.
Well, now, I remember when Imam told us, if people don't want to hear it, marry your young people young.
That's right. That's young people young.
And this wasn't no 50 years ago when I called up there. The brother had forgotten about that. I had to remind him. So that tells me that there's no attempt. Now, we can try to do things with young people. We can't make them do anything. But there needs to be an effort, especially in a masjid like Atlanta, where you got over 1,000 people coming to Jumu'ah. Now, I'm not going to necessarily blame it on any man, but the fact of the matter is, I got granddaughters who are familiar with the young people in the masjid, and they doing some alarming things, evidently. And they leaving the community at an alarming rate. We got to follow the wisdom of Imam Muhammad. Now,
yes,
as Imam, I'm not given to just articulation. I'm going to try. Now, my granddaughter does not necessarily want to go against the cultural norm, but ever since she's been 15 or 16, I've been drumming this in her head. Now, she may or may not be able to find some young Muslim male of character. She may not be able to do that. But we're making the effort. That's all we can do. Really, ultimately, the decision is with Almighty God as to what happens on this earth. You know that. We shouldn't give up so easy.
No, we shouldn't.
Listen, we shouldn't become discouraged. I remember marveling at the steel wheel of the brothers in the Nation of Islam. It took a lot for them to give up on the instructions of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. It seems that just a little minor resentment, just small obstacles, and we ready to reject the wisdom that the Imam gave us, throw it in the closet somewhere, and we go on living as if we never heard it. Now, that's a shame.
It is a shame. It's a shame. Yes, it is. No question about that. I want to ask you, we're going to mix it up with our community and the politics in the African-American community. And we're going to mix up some questions about the political arena. I want to ask you, what do you make of the fact that Imam Muhammad decided to name his ministry Mosque Cares? He could have named it the Holy Masjid. He could have named it the place of knowledge, but he decided to say the Mosque Cares. Why such a name?
Brother Imam, you know, and I'm not going to pretend to give you any information as if you don't already know, but most of the prophets archetypically was shepherds. And the shepherd is the ultimate caretaker. And the Imam was under that archetypal influence. He was a caretaker for all humanity. He was a caretaker for the mission of his mother and father and for the people in his association, but also for all humanity. So it's appropriate that other than the name of our religious institution, the first word he would put out there is care. The prophets, by nature, their number one attribute is to be a caretaker for Allah's servants. And the Imam cared. I don't know the history of an African-American leader And we've had some marvelous leaders, male and female, but I can't think of one who cared more about the human condition than the one who at one time was called a spokesman for human salvation. So that's an appropriate name. The man was trying to tell us, be like the prophet. Have a mission that is an excellent example and model of people who care. That's how I would answer that.
Now, would we be wrong to say charity starts at home and spread abroad? Should we not care about the state of African-American life? Or should we run over and be concerned about Palestine, Afghanistan, and other places before we're concerned about what's going on in Buttermilk Bottom, what's going on in Martin Luther King Boulevard? Should we be concerned? Would it be right for us to worry about what's going on around the world? But yet at the same time, my cousin, well, even my brother or my nephew, Ray Ray or Keisha, Apuka, they don't have jobs. Should I be concerned about it? Or Apuka doesn't even have a mind to get a job or even to think that, and I'm not condemning him, but should I be concerned that he's not concerned about a family? He's concerned that 50 years old are going to the pool room and perhaps even to produce a rap album. You know, I have a young man come to me, and I won't name him. He's pretty close to me, too. He's at 42 years old wanting to be a rap artist. Should I be concerned about that? But I should be worried about what's going on in a refugee camp somewhere 10,000 miles away from me.
Well, let's just look at our ultimate leader, Prophet Muhammad. You know and I know that he went to the cave. And one of the variables, though not the only variable, that drove him to that cave was that he was concerned about the fact that his people, the Quraysh, not the tribes in Medina, which was still in Arabia, not the people in the mountain city, are down in the land of Yemen. But initially he was driven to the cave because he was concerned about the bad conditions of his people. That's what drove the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to his personal cave, the cave that produced a social reformer. That's what drove Imam Waruddin Muhammad to his personal cave that produced a mujaddid that was the most proficient explicator of the message that came to Prophet Muhammad in that cave from Jibreel the Revelator as an instrument of God until the present. So how can we not be concerned about our people and claim those excellent individuals as our leader and example? From Prophet Muhammad, from the example of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, left Georgia, concerned about his people in Georgia, the lynching and the racism, on the run for years in prison because he was concerned. Imam Muhammad went to prison, fought the odds, came and changed teachings that were contradictory to the message of Muhammad because he was concerned about the plight of our people. I find it very difficult to accept any brother who stands up as a leader in America who does not have second to piety, a just heart, seeking injustice for our people. I find that very hard to accept.
Let me ask you this. Should I, as a Muslim, be concerned about self-help? You know what I find is very interesting? I just wanted to raise a question before I ask a question. Are people that have come out of the Nation of Islam, where the slogan was do for self, why is it now that they've come under the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, they have now abandoned self-help? And I heard African Muslims from Imam Muhammad's community saying somebody should give us jobs. Shouldn't we be preaching in our messages and our schools among ourselves, make job for yourself? What's wrong with that?
We tried to give to those Muslims who migrated to Medina an amount of help that the migrants were not comfortable with. And they, in effect, told them, let me do for self. Show me the marketplace. I don't need to see anything else.
Yeah, I all right, let's, we got that one. Let's go to the political arena. And U.S. Senator, well, I want to first ask you about the dropout of Mr. Rubio, Senator, United States Senator Rubio. And I want to just tell our audience, we don't call people by their names. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad took that away from us when we were in the Black Power movement. They would call people all by their name, and then America started disrespecting people. Even though America, there are people, elements in this country, some of the animals who have regressed from human level, were called the President of the United States, Obama. I heard African Americans call him Barack. That's your personal friend. I thought Sister Michelle, the First Lady, calls him that in public, the President. So I would wonder if you were to comment on United States Senator Cruz, Ted Cruz, that is. He's also a fellow constitutional law scholar. It seemed that he had run into some travails. But I want to first have you to comment on Mr. Rubio seemingly dropping out of politics and just what happened with him. Why he decided to go and become a pool room crap talker, as it were. Just give us some comments on that. What do you make of that as a Muslim scholar?
Well, first of all, I think that even before Senator Rubio went in the wrong direction in terms of his campaign, we got to remember that he went in that direction because already he had a subpar performance. This is a man that was touted by Time magazine as the savior for the Republican Party, front page. And they saw him as a Republican Obama, because they quit to underestimate President Obama. They consider his civil term, his low-intense charisma, what they consider to be his youthful good looks. And they quickly concluded that he's our savior, he's our Obama, our President Obama. But the truth of the matter is, there may have been some similarities in terms of style, but nowhere near any similarity in terms of character and substance. And so when put to the test of a grueling campaign with 17 candidates, and Donald Trump, businessman Trump, I'm going to follow your lead. Mr. Trump, well, in a way, he couldn't stand the muster. And Governor Christie of New Jersey went at his keen as ears. He understood that there was no substance there, that he was a creature of rote, repeating formulated statements by his staff and not really having deep substance beyond that. And when he stripped him of his clothing in that debate, I'm talking about Governor Christie.
Yes.
It was clear it was all over for Senator Rubio. That's my opinion.
Well, I take that seriously because you and Senator Rubio share something in common. Both of y'all went to the University of Miami Law School. So
yeah,
one wonders how he got out of law school with that kind of lightweight approach.
It's amazing to me. I mean, I've seen it before in terms of professional life where people are all front, but very depth to them in terms of reality. And unfortunately, I think that was a major problem with Senator Rubio.
And his reason for getting out of politics, you think that as he was stripped of his clothes by one Governor Christie, who should know something about taking people's clothes off, from what I understand about him, the United States attorney say he's not in the business of exonerating him. And there's no real indication, as you perhaps know, I don't know if you've been following, the trial of Bridgegate has been pushed forward. So we don't know what's going to happen with the governor. But I just wonder, is this superficiality has caused your former schoolmate, I'm going to put him on you because y'all close to the South, and I don't, for some reason, want to claim the Senator Rubio. I think he would have made a great used car salesman myself. I didn't even ever think there was any real substance there. But I want you to comment on that. Did you think that he was so shattered that he decided to leave public life altogether?
I think it's not how you go out, Brother Imam. It's not going out, I'm sorry, politically. It's how you go out. If you go out behind some shenanigans that was brought against you that the average person, after reflection, understands that, then you have a possibility of coming back politically. But if you go out because a devastating revelation to your brand, and I'm not a god, so I say this with hesitation, I think that it's going to be very, very difficult for Senator Rubio to come back. Because it's not that he was unfairly treated and ran out to race. It was because irreparable damage may have been done to his brand. He may not ever be able to remake his brand.
What do you make of the accusations? I'm not asking you to be a trial facts, but I do know that Mr. Trump, president of the Trump Organization, has said he was going to let the cat out of the bag. And it seemed now that the National Enquirer, which I must tell you, National Enquirer has been pretty accurate, but I know that Mr. Trump might have served as a source because they did endorse Mr. Trump.
Well, it's coming out now. It's coming out now, Brother Imam, that he has a monetary and business connection with the National Enquirer. So with that fact coming out, I don't know how much weight I'm going to use the Enquirer as evidence in this matter.
Okay. So you think the United States Senator Cruz will perhaps survive this?
I'm listening to the media. See, when these kind of things come out, If they smell blood in the water, they start, every show hit it hard at the top news item for the day. Biden politically is a low-level news day. It's not anything going on in the predatory American media. Love to find a story on Friday. So when you see these people pushing this story back until after the first 30 minutes, they're not really vamping on it, then that's an indication. And they have no love for Cruz, because Cruz is, Senator Cruz is not a cash cow. What do I mean by that? The president and top CEO has not stated that, well, we want to see Donald Trump stay, Mr. Trump stay in the race, because he's generating large sums of money for us. The American media is feasting off of Mr. Trump. And let me paint a scenario with that. He wins the nomination. Okay, they say, well, we want some sensationalism and big ratings all the way to the general election. So what are they going to do? They're going to let him come out with a silly pivot. They're not going to examine it. They're not going to bring up any of this information that he said in the primary. That's totally absurd. And they want an even contest. Now let's say for speculation that he defeats Hillary Clinton. The same dynamic is going to be at play. Let's keep him on the news every day. But then he's going to make demands, man, slant the news the way he does now. Slant the news the way I want you to slant it. Or otherwise, I'm not going to allow you in the room. I'm going to do you the way I did Miss Kelly on Fox News. So then you got a presidency where the media is now almost totally dominated by a political figure. Then, after making a pivot, these races and Lil Bubba, I know them, who put all their faith in Trump, after a year or so, when they see he's not going to deliver with anything, they're going to start saying they're disappointed and going to want to walk away. Then his poll numbers for re-election is going to start dropping. In order to win these folks back, not only is he going to have to advocate verbally, he's going to have to now do something that reflects the rhetoric that they want to hear in terms of governmental policy if he's going to get elected. In the media now, even out of his hands by then, won't say a mumbling word. So my point is, the media is more biased in a big way toward Trump. They have no reason to protect Ted Cruz, Senator Cruz. So if they felt they had anything of value against Senator Cruz that would knock him out the way and let Trump get this thing hands down, Mr. Trump get it hands down, then they would be hitting this thing all day long. But they're not doing that, buddy, ma'am. I hope you're still there. What they're doing,
I'm feeling you. You know, we got to use a little bit of speech. We ain't gonna pull all our African American nuances away. So I feel you. I want to
So that's what we see happening with this thing.
I want to turn the attention to a program I saw on MSNBC between two lawyers, and they litigated this really well yesterday. I must tell you, I'm not a fan of MSNBC, and the reason I'm not a fan of them, they owned by Comcast. It used to be my carrier. And Comcast told me they objected to me broadcasting on religion means alive and using our phone line. So they asked me to find another carrier. So Comcast, I'm not with you. So I don't like MSNBC. But
well, I don't like them now either because of the fact that Donald Trump's attack against Megyn Kelly, Mr. Trump's attack, made Fox News made some of the supporters of Trump turn against Fox News. Fox News started dropping in ratings. Bill Griffin, the CEO at NBC, and Jeff Zucker, the CEO at CNN, in order to grab some of that audience, began to tack right in a big way. And it worked because within the last couple of months, NBC, that was almost about to go down, they had a big purge of many of their advocates, Ed Schultz, Melissa Harris Perry, and many others, Skip Al Sharpton of his Daily Show. That was part of the purge to tack right. And then as NBC actually ended up outdueling Fox through the work of Morning Joe, who was a virtual commercial for Donald Trump. He has almost his own network within a network. By that I mean other programs that's on the former Representative Scarborough's influence in the sense that the broadcasters are part of his camp. I can give you two examples. This guy that come on that's named Thomas Roberts. When Morning Joe, who hated Ruby, or everybody knew it, a story came out in the New York Times, wanted to finish him off, he sent his protege, Thomas Roberts, to northern Florida, South Alabama, and Georgia, to his hometown area, Pensacola, Florida. That's where Morning Joe was elected as a congressman. And from the first morning when I saw Roberts down there, I said, hey, Representative Scarborough getting ready to move in for the kill. He also had great influence in these guys, Mark Happen and John Halliman, that got prime time at 5 o'clock. Happen called Obama a dickhead once.
Wow.
And Morning Joe patted him on the wrist for a couple of days and then brought him on. So with those moves, let's see how many hours during the day that are virtually Trump's commercials on MSNBC. 2 or 3 hours with former Representative Joe Scarborough. Thomas Roberts for 2 hours from 12 to 2 o'clock. And these other fellas on prime time at 5 o'clock. This is a fact. So I used to watch MSNBC. It's not that they love Trump. They love the money that Trump is making. They love the ratings that they've gotten from absorbing the disenchanted Fox viewers because Fox came against Mr. Trump to so that they could not be seen as being so cowardly that they would not protect one of their number one players, Ms. Megyn Kelly.
Let me ask you this. What do you make one of the largest shareholders of Fox, the prince of Saudi Arabia, who is titled, proper title is the Grand Custodian of the two sacred masjids there in Saudi Arabia. Prince Waleed is one of the largest shareholders in Fox News. What do you think Mr. Rupert Murdoch and the Prince Waleed, what do they have in common? Fox is both the right wing. Mr. Waleed will be a zealot Muslim. I don't know if he's a zealot Muslim, but he's certainly supposed to be a Muslim. What is the connection, or is there any connection?
It is a connection, but let me answer that question this way. There is a big magazine out, an Atlantic magazine, with President Obama on the cover. And they're doing a special on what's called the Obama Doctrine. And it's about a 12 to 13 page article. And if you really read it, you can get inside of the balanced mind of President Obama, which is really reflective of the thought process of Imam Walter D. Muhammad. And Obama makes it clear that he's absolutely disgusted with the leadership in the Muslim world, especially Saudi Arabia. President Obama, brother Imam, is from Chicago. Don't think he's aware of the fact that these same Saudis that he resent came to Imam Muhammad and tried to boy him down and told him?
Would you explain what do you mean, boy him down? A lot of us aren't Southerners, so we don't know what it means to be boyed down. You mean they will go offer him? Just tell us more about what it means to be boyed down.
A man that's from a line of Yang-like strong XY African-American male, especially his father, full of manhood, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they came to this man's son with an offer, we'll give you such and such money if you let us be your fathers in religion. Well, that Caucasian had attempted to be our father for 400 years. If the Imam had accepted that offer, he would have been boyed down in a super way. But thanks to Allah, he told them where to go. The Saudis did not want a strong version of Al-Islam to pop up in America or anywhere else in the world, because that would take away their power as the top dogs in this religion. So they have imported all around the planet a weak version of Al-Islam, knowing that the people couldn't do anything with it and that there would never rise a competitor in terms of really understanding this deen in modern life. But Allah surprised them when he raised up the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Imam Walter D. Muhammad. They recognized that many Imams have reported that when he went over there and taught them, some of them made that Imam. But acknowledging in a private context is not the same thing as publicly supporting him. And when they knew that he would not distort what Allah had given him, they tested him with big money. And the Imam rejected that offer and stood forward and made us all proud, especially African-American men, that he was able to turn away the temptation. So to answer your original question, those people are about turmoil on the earth. And they were joined with the Jews, and then Yahoo, with with Murdoch or anybody else to carry out their nefarious agenda.
Now, you know, there's a piece in the Atlantic Monthly I just read on an interview with the president. I had an opportunity to read it. It was just forwarded to me. But I will say this. It seems that the president is not a very sheepish person. I think ISIL will admit that today because its deputy leader was killed. And he's no longer around. And this is a question I have to ask you. For all the scholars in the audience who consider Arabic to be the most important thing we should be learning, according to Platel Benjamin, a noted journalist, one of the few African Americans who know a lot about Islam, and Platel Benjamin is a good friend of mine, but he's an atheist, but he's studied extensively. The leader of the so-called ISIL has a PhD in Islamic history and religious sciences. But it seems that to me that president that's supposed to be so sheepish and so soft has sent special ops in, and he hadn't gotten credit for this. Everybody, the big story seemed to be what's going on in Brussels, but no one has gotten really given the proper attention to the president's pursuit of these killers. These people are not Muslims. They are murderers. They are thugs. Many of them don't even practice the faith at all, even the ritualistic things. So what do you make of this point that these Fox News and others are going to say that the president is soft?
I make it of it as the same propaganda that they've been using since he's been in office, unfair against him, playing into the stereotype of ham, frivolous, clowning, non-serious, unable to bear the burden of government, politics, and civilization. That's what I make up of all that. And I categorically dismiss that. I wouldn't lend a ear. Let me give an example. They was talking about the president's performance with Daesh in Syria, but especially in Iraq. He said, look, we have a strategy. Let's give it time to work. One of the distinguishing attributes, Brother Imam, that make Daesh different from Al-Qaeda is that Daesh was not based upon roving here and there, engaging in terroristic acts. They had a strategy to seize territory, come together, and establish what they call a caliphate. That was their strategy. And they grabbed large chunks of land in Syria and in Iraq. As we speak, they are losing most of that land. The forces have gone in and taken Ramadi from them, and now they're getting ready to take their stronghold, Mosul. Over in Syria, they just are taking over the city of Palmyra, which were under their control. They're losing 30% of their territory. So consequently, now you don't hear them talking about a caliphate anymore. I'm talking about the American media, because that superficial idea has been destroyed by Obama's leadership. And it's impossible for them to even have a dream of doing that now. So what are they doing? They scattering, they running, coming back into Europe because they see defeat in Syria and in Iraq. Now, adopting tactics of Al-Qaeda that they said they never would adopt, hitting the midst with these individual terrorist acts. Now, if you give Obama and his leadership a chance to deal with this new development, you will see success, just like you saw when his strategy played out with this stationary caliber type grabbing a territorial situation. But they don't want to do that because they understand the fragile state of American mind. So they hit him with undue criticism before the thing could play out. But let me give an example with that. Bush invaded Iraq in 2003. They gave President Bush all the way to 2007. After blowing it, they still gave him a chance to have this so-called surge. You didn't hear any weak, feckless talk about him. He, Cheney Rumsfeld, could not even get Osama bin Laden. So when you understand the myth, and it goes back to scripture, we got to convince, especially African-American people, that your man is a failure. Don't you get any ideas? You all are inferior. Just like he botched the presidency, you're going to botch your life. That's the work of the enemies of African-American people.
Well, we're going to open the line up. I'm enjoying this. We have with us attorney Yusuf, the first is Imam. Attorney, still active prosecutor, former legislator. I hope he's analyzing the war today in the state of Alabama. I don't know what's going on in that state. We got the governor. Well, I don't know if he's in trouble or not, but he certainly looked nervous to me on television. And I'm not a trial.
Well, I
factor.
Suggest that the divine scrap has been taken out. Brother, ma'am, we need Muslims all over the country dealing with this situation the way we're trying to do today. We got some brilliant imams, you being one of them. I respect your erudition in terms of religious discipline, and I appreciate that. But people need to understand that this stuff affects us. And we need a brother on the case like Yusuf Abdul Salam that's bringing this understanding to us. And I'm hoping that God will have mercy upon us and bring more and more viewers, not just Muslims, but yes, Muslims particularly, but all Americans, to hear what we're saying on this show. It's important. And if you look at the way I talk, I'm doing what a lawyer does. When he presents the case, he must marshal the facts and shape the evidence to make a case. And that's what it's all about, my brother.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you think we have made our case to the African-American peoples, people such as Michelle Alexander, on to Joy Reid and others, thinkers and what I'm asking, did we make our case to the punditry of African-America? And have we made our case to the people of America? And the question is, what is our case? So I want you to kind of give us a thumbnail sketch. What are the, what is our case? And the second part is whether we have made our case.
If I could talk to, let's say, Sister Alexander, and I hear Connie L. West and all these folks talking about the book she's written is a classic on incarceration. There's some good information in the book. But the book has a fatal flaw because it deals with the dynamics behind the mass incarceration but it does not deal with the mass incineration that took over African-American males in the early 70s when we got caught up in Superfly and the passions of trying to hustle in this world's life. That was always available, but the fire was kindled to a blaze in the 70s. And then in the mid part of that period, the Imam came on the scene as a mercy with blight, arrest, and patrol and other strategies to try to put out the fire. But he was not supported by responsible African-American leadership. And when many of these deadly laws were passed, and they were being shaped and formed in the mid-80s and extended in the 90s, you had African-American people and African-American neighborhoods demanding that something be done by the runaway crime, Brother Imam, that was resulted from the blazing incineration that was going on. And yet, they can relieve some of these brothers, let them go, change incarceration laws. But if nothing is done to put out the massive incineration that started with our people, today I saw in Selma, Alabama, I saw two women that love each other. And I'm sitting in a restaurant eating, and me and another brother who wanted to talk to me, looking out the window. Caucasian sitting next to us. And they out in front of the window, two female lovers, biting each other like cats and dogs. They start fighting, and then one come back and yell out, "If you're going to be out there screwing men, then I'm going to do it too." So they female lovers, but evidently they got some residual desire for male intimacy. When you see that kind of stuff happening, Brother Imam, in a city, in a town like Selma, let me tell you, the fire is kindled to a blaze. But the incarceration idea allows us to wrap ourselves in victimhood. But the challenge of the incineration demands that we take community responsibility to work as firemen to put the fire. So that's what I would tell the sister. I would give her credit for her good work in her valid points, and then I would lay out an area that is more important that she totally missed.
What would you mix of your fellow Alabamian while we're on this mass incineration, Angela, Sister Angela, Professor Angela Davis, Dr. Angela Davis, I always like to call everybody by that title, that is for eliminating prisons, period. Now, you're a prosecutor. You've been a defense lawyer. And now you're on the other side, you prosecute. Would you just open jails, just leave everybody out of jail, as Sister Angela and perhaps as Sister Professor, fellow law professor, Alexander is advocating? What we do, we just should open up the prisons and let all these people out?
Certainly not. And if we did that, The primary victims of such an ill-conceived strategy, you know and I know, would be African-American people back in their community. Not to say that the concept of prison as implemented in America does not have any room for great reform. It does. But just a random, whole-scale release of inmates, that would be a disaster in America in general, but especially in our community. Let me tell you what's happening with that. Sister Davis has a brilliant mind. but she's a materialist.
Yeah.
Devoid of any inclination toward revealed knowledge influence. And she grew out of the Western California experience. And Robert Seale, the chairman of the Black Panther Party, all of them got caught up in this problem. And that, I'm reading Seize the Time now, and Newton's book, Revolutionary Suicide. I mean, I read it back in the 60s, but it's clear the statement that killed them was when Robert Seale made the statement that we want Malcolm, but we want him without the religion, especially a life of moral discipline. And if we study other than the external state repression of the Panthers, it was their own lack of moral discipline that brought them down. Only Elvis Cleveland, with all his messed up problems, had some inclination that the moral reform strategy of the Nation of Islam was vital. George Jackson, Angela Davis, Huey P. Newton, and Robert Seale ignored that. Now, later on, I've read some statements where Brother Seale acknowledged that that may have been a mistake, because they attempted a complete break from the church. And if you listen to one of their spokesmen on this new documentary, he's up there saying that we were not after church folk. We were not out after Muslim folk. What did they want? Brothers from the street that was already halfway on fire. The fire that was started with that development, those brothers were good hearts, had good hearts, but they were ignorant and not understanding that all life begins in water. And if you take away the water, you're not about to revolutionize anything in the Black community. So, and I can still hear a disrespect for moral and spiritual guidance if Angela Davis made that proposal.
Yeah, it seems to me one of the problems is the failure to address moral reform. And that, in other words, Ray Ray is free to pilfer, which I'm going to bring up to you another book that I've come across. I didn't finish reading it, but it was recommended by a friend of mine, called The Silent Majority. And in this book, this author discusses the crack epidemic and even the heroin epidemic that was plaguing Harlem and many other Harlems, so much so that Harold Cruz recommended that we use our Second Amendment rights to actually pick up arms and arm people. This is 1968. I don't think anybody really addressed those problems. You know, we talk about letting people out of jail, but let's address the mass implosion. You and I know we always had the pool room crowd, we had the cutthroat crowd, but they were very, very small numbers. And they were not valorized by the Murray McLeod, Bethune, Dr. King, and nobody else. It was only until the late 60s that these people were actually valorized, romanticized, and brought to the top and brought into the discussion. What do you have to say about that, Brother Imam?
I think, again, you had this idea, this materialistic idea that we need the lumpen. They call them the lumpen proletariat. You know about that. But a lump was a tumor. The Jews who threw that language out there knew exactly what was going to happen if you go at the so-called lumping. A moral cancer would develop in the community. A big tumor, a big mass. So they attempted to go for the lumping without any surgery to move the lack, to remove the lack of moral development in the soul that was developing in the late 60s. Then you had the development with music and hip hop and all this other culture deaf influences that pour gasoline on the fire. The first thing Farrar did was to indicate to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you lumping folks, your identity is what? What's yourself? Myself is a righteous Muslim. So he would not have dared to recruit the lumping people in that state without emphasizing the primary strategy is righteous moral reform. That didn't happen out there.
Yes, I agree with you 1,000%. I was telling the author of the book Condemning Blackness, Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, we were in the living room of Professor Glenn Lowry, and I said to him, he was saying that the lumping proletariat, he was recommending, I said, your great-grandfather, Abdullah Muhammad, made the lumping proletariat check his lumpiness at the door. In other words, you can come in and talk about street life and his reform centers. So I think there's a problem with Black Panthers. I think there's a problem with all the rest that romanticize the whole criminal lifestyle of the lumping lifestyle. And unless until there's a reformation of that, I don't see how we're going to ever get the masses of our people out of this incarceration and this mass incineration culture, unless we do a massive effort toward calling them back to their senses. Do you see any alternative to that?
No, I don't see any alternative. Again, all life, physically and any other way, human life begins in water. Allah's throne is not over the land, it's over the water. Okay, let us know unequivocally that the Ma Foundation has primacy when it comes to excellent human life. And you can go against that principle, that godly principle at your peril. And that's exactly what African-American people, not just the narrow. I remember when I was growing up, you catch a brother in the street, he still has some fear of God. But we always had this element. Now you have young men and women from so-called good families desiring that kind of life. That's because the fire is coming to a blaze and anybody now can get caught up in it.
That's the reason you advocate. You support Imam Muhammad in early marriages and building a program for our young people to develop family life. You seem to be very adamant about that. And
I'm very adamant. I told my granddaughter, okay, you get in college, but you're not going to a college environment where almost half of the female students are sexually molested. It's criminal, in my opinion, given those stats. As African Americans, it's hard for us to make an independent adjustment. If the system don't tell us, look, these campuses are not safe, we're going to start a strategy, make an adjustment, and we're going to educate all young Americans at home, if the system don't tell us that, we're not going to creatively look at the situation. How can I have my young people educated, but without exposing them to these new risks that traditionally have not existed in the college educational experiment? So I tell them, look, go to college in your neighborhood, get your job, save your money, avoid college debt, so when you come out, you're not a slave to the debt system that Bernie Sanders is playing on in terms of American college students. Secondly, you get that, that's your top priority. Secondly, once you get that straight, you're out of high school now, 19, 20, let's start systematically looking for a spouse. Let's start systematically looking for a spouse. If you got the husband and the wife on the same stage, you'll get cooperation with that. But if they shift the vision,
in the Nation of Islam, which had a lot of mythology and primarily, there was a great push to get people married. Now there's a hush. There's an urgency to make wudu. There's an urgency for rituals. What one of my friends, Mr. Hakeem Hassan, calls urban Sufism. But for the real social work that needs to be done, there seems to be no emphasis on that. What's up with that?
You know, I got a good young Muslim family here in Alabama that I've known for years. I got the brother. He claimed to love Imam Muhammad. And I got to running down to him what the Imam said on the matter. He bought into it. He has some sons. He came back and told me that his wife does not want them to get married young. But what are these sons going to do? They're going to go to college, and they're going to start having relations with non-Muslim women. We see it all the time down here. And the habits that come with that almost make a young man unsuitable to be the spouse of a young sister that's been brought up and Alice up. We're not talking about people like us who came to Alice with all kind of crazy habits. We're talking about people that have been generally raised in a good Muslim environment. The guy goes out there, pick up these habits, turn 25, 26, and go on to bring that mess to a good Muslim sister that tried to struggle and maintain her cleanliness and her purity. There's no way, brother. Quran says clearly, the pure for the pure and the impure pure for the impure. Now, I'm not trying to be saintly. I believe in Quranic science. The Bible says that people must be evenly yoked. Brother, young brother out there been doing everything he want to do after high school, sowing his wild oats, and then you want to come throwing on some Muslim sister that the people that want out there laying with everything. And even then, some of them may do it, some of the sisters. But I've seen they do make an effort. They're going to make an effort. Then you take 10 steps to try to help facilitate that. That's my attitude. And I'm going to be very disappointed if these young sisters around here can't find a decent Muslim brother that want to marry them the way our religion teach us. Be very, very disappointed.
And what is even
part and parcel of that disappointment, there are no classes for men. Young men that want to go right, young men that want to remain virgins. You know, I'd say, we're not talking about people like you and I. We're not even talking about people. You know, it's sad that, there was better moral social habits in the Nation of Islam than there are now. I just don't understand why we can expect for our young men to come up, our young women to come up, and we don't have classes for them.
We need classes, we need supportive institutions, and that's really the best dialogue we can have.
Yes.
We're talking about generational transmission of Al-Islam. Brother, what good is it for you and your wife, or me and my wife, to knock ourselves out for a generation to try to establish this deen? We pass away. And it's not transmitted to another generation. Man, that's ridiculous. Ain't no way in the world I'm going to be part of that insanity. I'm going to make an effort to make sure. Well, Abraham made the prayer, asking for blessings beyond the generations. Then Allah shot back, my promise is not within the reach of the evildoers. So we are both going to get grown and get to do whatever they want to do. How do we think that our prayer to Allah to make sure our generations are Muslims, how do we think that can be answered? That's dawah. How can we bring other people to the deen if we have people that are already Muslim and we lose them?
Abracadabra. But you know, Billy Ma'am, I'm going to say this before we close. I have known so many Muslims to argue with Imam Muhammad on early marriage and then wonder why their son ended up in a tragic series of relationships, bad, illicit relationships, with perhaps even Hep C, a whole string of pregnancies that now puts him in a spiral of child support issues and just tragedy. And the same thing with our young women. Because we failed.
No doubt about it, but I'm from the South, brother, ma'am. Let's eliminate Al-Islam.
And I think we got 4 minutes to answer that question.
Well, let's eliminate Al-Islam. When I was in the South, growing up, if a young lady got pregnant, agnostic, Christian, or what have you, 15, 16, 17 years old, they were going to get married. And I know many couples that ended up with that. And they stayed married for the rest of their lives. And that was a solid tradition in the African-American community. You got pregnant, you made one mistake, get married. I didn't hear a whole lot of talk about that girl too young to marry. That guy,
we
ain't got him a job at the plant.
But
he
man,
was right
also
after
remember that the women also, or the, well, they didn't do the men, but they would have a woman had to go in, up in front of the church and beg the church pardon for having a baby out of wedlock. You recall that? That was a shaming.
They should have done it to the men, too. They should have done it to the men, too, brother, man. But yeah, they had to do that.
That was a mistake.
Now,
they didn't do it to the men, but they did it to the women. But at least they had, there was notice served on the community to see that a woman had to go and beg the church pardon for violating the norms and standards of that society, that particular church community. And the Nation of Islam hit the rule.
What now, my brother? I didn't hear the last statement.
The Nation of Islam made that rule. So I just think we just let anything go, let it all hang out. You know, that's what kind of society we wonder why we ended up reaping the whirlwind.
Brother, it's a mess out in there. After I saw that one incident, I went to another place to get some gas, and he'll come. Now, this is, you got to know, Selma, Alabama. 10 years ago, you couldn't see these kind of things in the same day. The two women coming in there looking like Barillas, like they will corrupt the whole store, and they were mates.
But you call them Barillas?
Once you lose the moral cloak, buddy, ma'am, then it goes to further and further extreme levels. We got to get back to the moral cloak. And I don't say that as any pretensions of being a saint. I started having sex at a very, very young age. One of the reasons why I came to this deen, however, was the big habits that I started in Jahiliya. But you and I both know breaking a habit and the residual effects of that habit is very, very hard psychologically. That's why we have to raise the children up without these bad habits, and they can stick with that, train a child in the way they should go. So now nobody is a saint. You're not a saint. My wife is not a saint. She didn't hear this stuff when I knew her beyond this deen. You feel me? But she knows better now. She tried to teach it to her daughters and teach it to her granddaughter and her son. That's what progress is all about. If our dean can't deal with these basic problems of backwardness to bring each generation into a higher level of progress, we need to go somewhere and sit down.
Peace be on. Well, we've come to an end of a program. This is a wonderful program. I think we have to do this once a month, is have an interview. I'm glad I was able to facilitate it. But you've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred. We graciously was blessed by Allah to have with us Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. Peace be on our honorable and noble listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.